Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. One of the key clinical research developments in the last 5 years in management of non-small cell lung cancer has been the rapid evolution of the use of adjuvant systemic therapy. And several months ago, a major practice guideline on adjuvant therapy was published in the JCO jointly by Cancer Care Ontario and ASCO. Dr. Mark Criss was co-author on this historic paper, and I met with him to discuss this and other recent developments in the field. Dr. Criss began our conversation by commenting on the extensive deliberations of the adjuvant guideline group and their key conclusions.
The first thing was the unanimity of the group that adjuvant therapy, particularly adjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy, improves survival. And to get that message out, I think everybody agreed that that was the important message. And people felt very strongly that that needs to be put out there as a standard of care. Of course, the devil is in the details. I think there was very uniform agreement that the data was strong for stage 3A and for stage 2. And to a person, folks were very clear about stating that this is a standard of care and should be followed, and I think the guidelines reflect that. As you read the guidelines, though, you'll see areas where the recommendations are not quite as strong. I think the first one is in the area of stage 1B disease. The truth is there was only one clinical trial that specifically addressed that group, and it did not show a benefit. Conversely, all the other trials that did show a benefit, their primary endpoint was improvement in 5-year survival in the entire study population. So for the Canadian trial, the BR10, the IALT trial, the ANITA trial, all those trials included stage 1B patients in the population of patients they considered candidates for adjuvant therapy. And all three of those trials were convincingly positive. When you pull out the subgroups, though, from those trials and do a subgroup analysis, the magnitude of benefit for the different stages is different. The smallest is for 1B, the largest is for 3A. And so to prove the significance of benefit of chemo in those various groups, you need a lot more patients in the 1B group, and you didn't have that.
And of course, we saw this evolve over 20 years in breast cancer, where initially the trials and the node-negative patients were negative, and it got to be an events thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely analogous to that. So what we were left with in stage 1B is, because they were included in the overall group, I think people felt strongly to recommend adjuvant therapy. However, when you do that subgroup analysis, it's not clearly beneficial, at least in terms of a p-value. And that's the reason for the recommendation that you see. I think people felt strongly that you should think about it in every patient, but you can't uniformly say everybody should have it, probably because of the lack of data specifically in that group.
It was interesting the way you guys actually worded it. With 1A, adjuvant chemo is not recommended. 1B, adjuvant cis-based chemotherapy is not recommended for routine use. And then 2A and beyond is recommended.
Yeah. I think it's more a reflection of the adequacy of the data that we had. There was virtually no data to suggest that treatment would be helpful in 1A. The very few trials that addressed it in sort of different settings failed to show any benefit for that. But 1B, again, was one that the data was, though there was no specific data for cisplatin-based chemotherapy from a trial designed to treat that group, there was the data as part of the larger groups.
How do you yourself approach the 1B patients off study?
Yeah. Well, I'm of a mind that they should be offered adjuvant therapy. I would probably take that even one step further, that even the stage 1A patients should be offered it too. And my first comment on that, again, comes from the breast cancer experience. If you had a breast cancer patient with that risk of death at 5 years, you would be recommending adjuvant therapy. And even with the new staging system, with the tiniest tumors that are going to be coming down the line, their 5-year survival is still at a level where if it were breast cancer, you'd be recommending adjuvant therapy. Now, what I am short on today is proof that the treatment is going to work in those patients. But I think in a fit patient, then it's an issue. In a fit patient, it's worth trying. And just as in any patient, it's risk versus benefit. Obviously, somebody who has comorbidities, giving the therapy for a potential benefit perhaps is going to be not what's to be recommended because the chance of harm could outweigh the potential for good. Conversely, in a totally fit patient, I think the risks are such that it makes sense to try to do that.
It's interesting because there's also, I think, a big analogy to colon cancer where you have the NSABP who puts the node-negative and node-positive, high-risk node-negative and node-positive patients in the same trial, doesn't subgroup them out, kind of like what you were talking about with the other trials other than the CALGB trial. And out of that came this concept of relative risk reduction, which was the belief that no matter how low you go in the absolute risk, you're going to lower it somewhat by, I guess, adjuvant therapy. And there's this huge debate in colon about it. Breast, they've sort of accepted it. It sounds like kind of you believe inherently, even though we don't have the data, that that model works or applies in lung cancer.
It makes sense to me. But again, this is opinion. This is in fact. The truth is the only facts are from 1B to 3A. And there are differences in overall improvement and proportional improvement across those different stages.
What about selection of chemotherapy, cis versus carbo, and what to pair with it?
Well, the data doesn't give you many choices. The only trial that used carboplatinum was negative. All the meta-analysis in stage four say that carboplatinum is probably inferior in stage four, though not tremendously so, but it is inferior when you crunch all the numbers. I did an analysis years ago of the neoadjuvant, and it was the same observation, that it's somewhat worse. So here, where the goal is cure, and you're dealing with an inherently fitter population of patients, cisplatinum makes the most sense. And I think that's the feeling of majority of oncologists. It's sort of interesting that even people that would automatically give carboplatin to somebody with stage 4 disease would more likely than not give cisplatinum for somebody with stage 2 disease.
Well, it's interesting. We just completed our first patterns of care study in lung cancer. We've done these in breast and prostate and colon. And there's a major difference in selection of adjuvant chemo in the clinical investigators we surveyed in docs in practice. Clinical investigators, pretty much cis. Docs in practice, 3-1 carbotaxel over everything else. I'm sure that doesn't surprise you.
No, it doesn't surprise me at all.
It's just kind of an interesting dichotomy, one of the strongest differences we've seen between investigators and docs in practice and in any of the tumors in this question. What about the patient who the doc has or you have some reservations about using cis? Or do you feel like if you have a patient who got through surgery, they should be able to get through the cis?
Yeah, well, by and large, that's true because by the nature of this, they have already been through a morbid surgery. A pneumonectomy, for example, is the most morbid and mortal cancer surgery. More people die in complications of pneumonectomy than in hepatic resections, pelvic excenerations, Whipples, esophageal removals. I mean, it's really a morbid procedure in the population group we treat, you know, 70 and 80-year-olds. So the fact that they made it through that defines a certain kind of physiology where you can more often than not get away with it. Unfortunately, there are patients that have renal insufficiency. Hearing loss is a big problem. And then you have to make a compromise. And sadly, we don't have any data to do that at this point because all the clinical trials that showed benefit included cisplatinum.
Well, how do you approach the choice of agent to combine with cis in the adjuvant setting?
Yeah, well, I define with cis. At this point, that's pretty easy, too. I mean, if you look at all the trials, vinorelbine cis is the one that has had the most study. And from a practical standpoint, using the regimen from BR10, the Canadian trial, of 16 weekly vinorelbine infusions with cisplatin given on the first and second infusion of each month, that's a very tolerable regimen. I've personally made one modification on that regimen, and that is instead of adjusting the vinorelbine dose or holding it based on the count that day, knowing that some doses are going to be attenuated, I automatically give full and half doses on alternating weeks. As it turns out, if you do that, you end up giving a total dose of vinorelbine slightly greater than people got on the BR10 protocol where doses were held. The other thing that I found very useful in that approach is that patients receiving adjuvant therapy are really devastated when they don't get that therapy. I mean, they see it as a step toward cure. They're also impatient. They want it over. And to either not get a dose or lengthen your treatment is very upsetting to them. So being able to give a dose on each day is something that everybody finds acceptable. And it turns out you end up giving more drug anyway. So I would recommend people try that because I think it's a more effective way of giving the vinorelbine.
Let's talk a little bit about research strategies in the adjuvant setting. And first, I'm curious about your thoughts about the ECOG adjuvant trial that just came out, looking at chemotherapy, three different types of cisplatin chemotherapy plus bevacizumab.
Yeah, well, I think that ECOG trial reflects the current state of the art. You know, it's the stages that have been studied. It's cisplatin-based chemotherapy. I think it tries to deal with realities that there are other drugs that work with cisplatin, and that's why it allows the various regimens that it does. In addition to vinorelbine cis, it allows gemcis and allows docetaxel cis. I think that the premise of the trial is exactly where we should be, where we're taking promising drugs that have been shown to improve survival and response in stage 4 disease patients and moving them up. I mean, that is how we select, in the absence of a truly targeted therapy, that's how we select treatments for adjuvant use. And clearly those criteria are met with bevacizumab. And so trying to move that up makes a lot of sense. Some caveats, though, about the trial. One is the ability to give those other regimens. I was of a mind that we could clearly potentially do a better job by giving docetaxel cis, because in the stage 4 setting, in the TAX 326 trial, docetaxel cisplatinum showed improved survival and response over vinorelbine cisplatinum. So it seemed to me obvious that we could do that. And we did two consecutive trials. Jerry Zoli at our institution led a trial, two trials, and also we did this in concert with the investigators at Johns Hopkins. And what we found was, at the end of the day, we really couldn't give more cisplatinum than we could. And the regimen, the overall kind of dose intensity, was not substantially better by giving docetaxel cis, which I thought would be a more tolerable regimen, particularly when we gave the docetaxel on a weekly schedule. But that didn't work out. Jerry Zoli published this in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology earlier this year. Now, that's one of the regimens that's used in the trial, and I think our conclusion there was that we thought it was a great idea, but we couldn't deliver it. The second thing is the likelihood for greater myelosuppression with the use of bevacizumab with the chemotherapy, like was seen in the Sandler trial as well, and something you have to watch out for.
What do you think is going on there, incidentally?
I don't have a mechanistic answer to that. I mean, we've seen that with other kinds of agents where it sort of makes no sense. Why does when you give erlotinib with vinorelbine, is there more myelosuppression? But there is. The second thing about that ECOG trial, and I would put this word of caution to practitioners, is for the patients with stage 3A disease, I think there is very strong inferential and some clinical evidence that radiation is important, that the patients who receive radiation have longer survival, and that is not permitted as part of the current intergroup trial. The ASCO guidelines clearly say that you should consider radiation in the patients with stage 3A disease. They clearly say also you should not be recommending radiation for stage 2 patients and patients with no nodal disease.
And that's your practice?
That has been my practice. But I think the data, though, from the ANITA trial and the data from the SEER analysis by Lally, and also even the older meta-analysis, fails to reveal any harm and clearly suggests the potential for benefit. And sadly, even giving our best adjuvant therapy and delivering it, doing our optimal surgery, only about half of patients with stage 3A disease are cured. So if we can do anything to improve that cure rate, I think we need to do it. And I think radiation is part of that. It's technology we have. Also, the technology is improving. Radiation oncologists have become very expert at delivering radiation without significant morbidity. And I don't see that as a drawback, though clearly it's a consideration, but that's not a reason to treat patients. So one caution in participating in that trial is for the stage 3A patients, make sure that radiation is not the right thing for them, because I think you would do them a disservice by not giving them radiation, because there is this pretty reasonable proof. With no nodal disease and with only N1 nodes, the guidelines clearly state you should not give radiation because there's no evidence of benefit, and non-randomized status available suggests possible harm. But for stage 3, there's no harm and two trials that show strong benefit. And we use that same kind of wording we used in the 1B, that while we would consider it or recommend it, we can't recommend it for routine use at this point. And the guidelines themselves state the reason for that, and that is the lack of specific data that says you should do this.
I guess the other thing about that ECOG trial that's interesting in terms of eligibility is they will allow 1B, but it has to be over 4 centimeters.
Yeah, I think that's another pitfall of that study. That 4 centimeter number is not the number that was selected by the staging group that looked at tens of thousands of cases. That number was based on just a few hundred cases. I'd be very careful in saying that that 4 centimeter number is indeed any sort of a standard, because our new staging system will not use that 4 number.
What are some of the other strategies that are being looked at in the adjuvant setting right now in terms of research?
I think the adjuvant setting truly lends itself to the use of therapies that can be either tailored or targeted, because in all of these patients, we have sufficient tumor specimen to allow us to measure a molecular characteristic that could be used. And there are a number out there that have potential benefit. I think one of the strongest one now is the RAS mutation. It's been shown, in my mind, quite conclusively that if you have a RAS mutation, your cancer cells have an innately different wiring than those that have an EGFR mutation. And drugs like erlotinib have had very limited benefit in these patients. I think there's only one response in the medical literature, and actually in the BR21 trial, where virtually every person who got erlotinib seemed to be helped, those that had RAS mutations not only were not helped, but their survival was decreased. That's probably a fact of small numbers, but I think it's pretty clear that it's not better. So it makes no scientific sense. The clinical data says it's not helpful. So I think if you had a RAS mutation, you would be somebody that you would not want to recommend a drug like erlotinib. In the BR10 trial, the Canadian trial for adjuvant therapy, they prospectively look at RAS mutations. And they collected the RAS mutation status on more than 90% of the patients. They found about a quarter of them had RAS mutations, which is exactly what you'd expect based on the biology of the illness. And what they found was in those patients that adjuvant cisplatin vinorelbine chemotherapy did not provide a survival benefit of 5 years.
When you say based on the biology, my primitive understanding is that somehow these tumors are bypassing these higher mechanisms. Can you explain it any more intuitively than that?
Well, there are certain oncogenes in certain cancer cells who are primarily dependent for their survival on these oncogenes. Mutated EGFR is a good example of that. So if you have a cancer cell with mutated EGFR and you take away that signal, the cells die, and the cells die by apoptosis. And this is also an oncogene. You insert mutated EGFR into a normal cell, it becomes cancerous. So that's a very fundamental process that you're dealing with. Same is true with RAS mutations, that those mutations are the driving mutations. RAS is an oncogene. You put RAS into a normal cell, it turns it into cancer. And these are really potent drivers of the malignant process, and I think really tell us something very fundamental about those particular cancer cells. Now, that's a minority of cancer cells. Of cancers that are driven by these oncogenes. It's probably a third overall. But for those, you can test for these things and you can use them to base your decision on them.
Is there any systemic therapy that works in those tumors?
In RAS mutated tumors, there isn't. But where it is helpful today is it tells you that an EGFR inhibitor is very unlikely to provide any substantial benefit. And particularly now we're talking about the adjuvant setting where you're talking perhaps 2 years of therapy. And we also, of course, have that cautionary note from the SWOG trial where they gave gefitinib, Iressa, to unselected patients after the conclusion of their radiation and chemotherapy, and their survival was less. And there are other trials as well, the Lilienbaum trial, looking at PS2 patients that were randomized to get either chemotherapy or erlotinib. Those that got erlotinib first had an inferior survival, unselected patients. So I do think there is something to be said about choosing those patients that have the characteristics of their tumor that suggest sensitivity or resistance to these drugs. And you have that capability with adjuvant therapy. And I urge it be followed.
And is that assay commercially available? Is it easy
absolutely
to get?
It's a standard sequencing assay. There are other techniques as well. It's done by commercial companies, and it's soon to be a standard of care in colorectal cancer. As you may have discussed already, in the European package labeling for panitumumab, RAS mutation testing will be required. There is a parallel data that the presence of a RAS mutation suggests insensitivity to cetuximab in colorectal cancer. And I think you're going to see RAS become a part of the standard of care of colorectal cancer. And my own urging would be that it become part of the standard care of lung cancer, determining RAS mutations. Any lab can do it. It's a standard Sanger sequencing that any lab can do.
When you're talking about predictors or looking at tissue, obviously it brings up the issue of EGFR mutations that you've done so much work in, and there are a bunch of trials out there now looking at that. Can you kind of provide an overview of that?
Yeah, well, the point about EGFR is that the cancer cell is sensitive to EGFR in a multitude of ways. And one thing that we're learning more and more about lung cancer, it is genetically extremely complex. And it's not one size fits all. It just isn't. The recent paper that came out just yesterday or the day before in Nature about, again, I think attests to the complexity and the number of genes involved in lung cancer. So EGFR mutation defines a subpopulation of lung cancer where the presence of that activated oncogene and activated EGFR is absolutely critical to survival of those cells. So you take away EGFR, the cell dies. But that's a small number. Conversely, though, when you find that number, those are the people that should be getting these drugs from day one. Now, there's an estimated nearly 20,000 new cases of EGFR mutated lung cancer in the U.S. alone each year. So this isn't like seven people. This is, you know, tens of thousands of people every year. So I think it makes a lot of sense to go after those people. And when you find them, find a way to get a tyrosine kinase inhibitor into their care.
You're saying in an off-protocol situation?
Yes, because to me it makes biologic sense.
So are you comfortable with clinical trials randomizing between a EGFR inhibitor and not in those patients?
In a mutated patient? Mm-hmm. I'd probably try to find a more clever way to do it. Though I can't prove to you today that by taking an EGFR inhibitor, your survival is going to be improved. By the same token, it's such a fundamental part of the wiring of those cancer cells that it's hard not to recommend it. Also, we know from the work that's been done, people can take this drug for years without any long-term sequela that we've seen. And again, these are not unselected patients. These are people where you have proven that they have this wiring. I would strongly be against giving it to an unselected population, to be honest with you, based on the data that's around. But for those selected people, I would urge that you consider doing it.
Well, you mentioned the relative ease compared to other therapies of using erlotinib specifically, but yet the rash, and this is coming up in colon cancer with cetuximab, et cetera, in the adjuvant setting is somewhat concerning. How do you see people responding to that?
One thing that you can do is you can titrate the dose to the rash. And we also know from biology that these cells are much more sensitive to these drugs. So whatever a standard dose might be, it's very likely you can inhibit, at least compared to wild-type EGFR, the mutant EGFR is 20 times more sensitive to the drug. So you can easily block its effects with a much lower dose. And we have been using gefitinib in the adjuvant setting now and have found that by titrating the dose, people can do it. There are some individuals that can't do it. If you've suffered a lot of other chemotherapy side effects, itching becomes not an important one. But if you're going to be itching for 2 years and the likelihood is you're cured, I mean, it becomes a much bigger concern. I think the nice thing about erlotinib is because you have all the different dosage sizes, you can adjust the patient. I think these mutated people very likely need a lower dose. Our standard practice now is to start people off study at a lower dose and titrate up or down. But I think you can use a lower dose effectively, and I think the basic science would support you doing that.
What are the other research strategies in the adjuvant setting that you think hold some promise?
The other one that folks have been taking forward is the use of predictive tests for the different chemotherapy agents. The one that's had the most discussion is ERCC1. ERCC1 is a gene that encodes for a protein involved in DNA repair. the more ERCC1 that you would have would suggest a greater capacity of a cancer cell to repair DNA damage. And DNA damage is the result of cisplatin's use. So your ability to repair it more efficiently would say that you'd be less sensitive to cisplatin. And lo and behold, in the IALT trial, where they had about 750 specimens available, what they found was that the benefit of adjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy was just not there in people that overexpressed this, about 40% of patients. Conversely, in the 60% of patients that don't overexpress that protein, they're the ones where the benefit was seen. So many have put forward that by measuring ERCC1 would be a way to help you decide whether or not cisplatin is the right drug for a patient. And we are doing it now routinely. I think it's one piece of information. It's not the only piece of information at this point. Its use and effectiveness is based on a subgroup analysis, though it does make theoretical sense. And it's a test, again, that any pathology department can do. It's obtaining a monoclonal antibody. It's going through their normal quality control processes within every pathology department in America and showing that it can be done. But it's a relatively simple test.
Now, there's a new staging system out for lung cancer. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, for many years now, there has been a huge effort trying to develop a better staging system for lung cancer. And the first report of this effort was at the International Lung Cancer Meeting in Seoul, Korea, back in September. There were also papers in the Journal of Thoracic Oncology in August of 2007. The papers are broken down into different areas. Some dealt with the issues of tumor size. Some dealt with nodal disease. To summarize, the reanalysis of the nodal disease criteria was such that no recommendation was made to change from the current staging. So the nodal stages are going to stay the same. The changes, however, that folks are going to make are in the size of the tumor. So there's been a proposal that I think people have largely agreed with to further subdivide the T1 and T2. The tiniest tumors would be T1A, and that would be less than or equal to 2 centimeters. There's now a T1B class, which is 2 to 3, and then T2A, which is 3 to 5, T2B, which is 5 to 7, and T2C, which is greater than 7. They have shown in the study population that they used to divide this that these are individual categories that separate themselves with some statistical robustness, and I think people have decided to do this. And I think particularly in the adjuvant situation, we're going to be doing this. And you'll notice you brought up before about the 4 centimeter thing now used in adjuvant trials, and that does not appear here. So again, please remember that was chosen on much smaller sample size than here. The other change in the system reflects a reality, and that is first that the presence of a pleural effusion suggests a much poorer prognosis and a prognosis virtually identical to patients with metastatic disease. So while the current staging will call that 3B, the next rendition of the staging would make that stage 4. The other issue that they tried to address was the issue of multiple primary tumors or multiple nodules in the same lobe of the lung. Under the current staging system, they were stage 3B, which is a stage where surgery is not routinely done. I think many of the surgeons, and I totally agree with them, if indeed that is all the disease a patient has, that removing that lobe with those 2 tumors makes sense. And these patients do have a survival of approximately 20 to 30%, which would suggest that that's the way that they should be treated rather than saying that they're not operable candidates. So the new staging is going to reflect that. So those are the main things, to subdividing tumors based on their size, taking the pleural effusion patients and making them with the stage 4, and then dealing with this idea of multiple nodules and saying that you should still think about, for those that are in the same lobe, removing them.
What about the issue of induction systemic therapy as opposed to postoperative adjuvant therapy?
Yeah. Well, in my mind, the use of induction therapy makes the most sense. If I could just take one step back, I think that the age of the single modality treatment of non-small cell lung cancer is quickly coming to a close. Just as we are, you know, removing brain metastases in people with stage 4 disease. I think it's very clear that we should be treating people with stage 1 disease. In the new staging, even the best category, the T1A, less than 2 centimeters, their 5-year survival, pathologically staged, is only 77%. So I would put it to you that is not where we want to be, and we have to think about using other modalities for these patients.
Now, a patient with breast cancer at that risk is going to get chemo for sure.
Yeah, and if they were ER positive, of course hormones, they would get hormonal therapy.
Of course.
So I think that's the first trend here, that we're going to be using multimodality therapy. So first off, multimodality therapy is the standard for most patients now, and I think over the next several years it's going to be the standard for all. Why do we try to supplement an effective local therapy like surgery? Are we improving the quality of the surgery? Are we improving local control? The answer is no. Surgery provides unbelievable local control. The rates are extremely high. And with radiation now given, the ways that it can be given with the precision and the ability to deliver a higher dose, we're seeing excellent rates of local control. The people that fail die from systemic disease. And the benefits of adjuvant therapy, and our current one is chemotherapy, is controlling systemic disease. So that being the case, and chemo being the treatment that we have, it makes no sense to me to wait to do chemotherapy. And I think there's fairly good data from randomized and non-randomized trials that you can safely give chemotherapy. That same data shows something else, and that is that chemotherapy is much more tolerable and that whatever dose you plan to give, you can give. You know, we routinely give roughly 60 to 70% of planned chemotherapy doses in the adjuvant setting. For the preoperative or neoadjuvant setting, induction setting, we give 90%+. So using breast again as an example, where 85% is the cutoff, I can give you that 85% if I give an induction. I cannot give it to you if I do it in the adjuvant. The third point about using induction therapy is that it gives you the opportunity to see if that drug or that treatment shrinks that human being's cancer. And as precise as some of the molecular testing is, it is still not perfect. Yes, an EGFR mutation, you have an 80%, but it's not 100. And the ability to assess effectiveness of treatment in an individual patient can only happen in the neoadjuvant setting. It can't happen in the adjuvant setting. And current technology is such that we're giving cisplatinum. And it is extremely difficult to give cycle after cycle of cisplatinum and not see if you're having any effect on it. I find it so much more reasonable to use cisplatinum where you can see if you're getting a tumor effect. I think it means a lot to the person. It means a lot to the whole healthcare team to do that. The other advantage of that is you can use that time while the tumor is still present to see if something that you might use as an adjuvant treatment is helpful as well. We have 2 trials at our institution right now where we are giving preoperative gefitinib, tyrosine kinase inhibitor, or preoperative Avastin, bevacizumab. And we're able to see in those patients that are giving one of those agents alone whether it's shrinking their tumor. And based on that observation, and of course based on the findings at surgery that we've had some successful adjuvant treatment, that gives us greater confidence in recommending these treatments adjuvantly. And we're in the process of doing clinical trials, testing that concept now. It's clearly doable, and I think that makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, plus, you have the ability to look at biologic correlates of what's going on.
You can do that. Unfortunately, how to do that is not worked out right now. I mean, the potential is there.
Is the problem the pre-op biopsy, getting the tissue out of that?
The problem is the pre-treatment biopsy.
Right,
that's one issue. But the second issue is I think most people get multiple treatments now. I don't think anybody is giving just erlotinib or just bevacizumab. And the people that you see, the surgical specimen that you have, and you might assess some biological endpoint, they've also had chemotherapy, so it makes it harder to do that. The one thing that we've seen with both gefitinib and with bevacizumab is that we can give them safely. We have not increased the morbidity of the surgery or the mortality as well, which is very, very important in these situations. And, you know, I think that other diseases where bevacizumab has been used more commonly, like colorectal cancer, it's sort of set the stage that you can successfully do and safely do surgery despite having bevacizumab on board.
You know, and the other tumors, people have talked about 6 weeks or so as the timing. What did you do in your study?
We sort of used that 6 weeks. Actually, we were the first to operate on people after bevacizumab. And I think there was some concern about that. What we've done is we have combined two different ideas. The one idea is to give that 6 weeks beforehand, so before surgery of not having bevacizumab. So we would plan, for example, 4 cycles of chemotherapy, but it turns out to be 5 cycles. The first cycle is bevacizumab alone. The 5th cycle is chemo alone, and the 3 in the middle are the 2 together. So in addition to giving a 6-week time period between the last bevacizumab and the surgery, people are still being treated with chemo, we also have that opportunity to give bevacizumab alone up front. And that gave us the opportunity to test in those individual patients. And for bevacizumab, what's its single agent activity, which nobody had done before.
Yeah, and it kind of reminded me a little bit of what Chris Willett did in rectal cancer, where I think they got 1 dose of Bev. They tried to see what was going on, and then they added. What did you guys
Our work was very much influenced by that.
And you actually saw a response, at least
absolutely,
Bev. Can you talk about what you actually saw in the study?
We're still analyzing the data, but it was very clear that most patients had some shrinkage. The majority had some shrinkage to Bev alone, which makes sense. What we're doing now is to fine-tune the CAT scanner readings. As it turns out, no one has really checked the reproducibility of the CAT scan for individual lesions. We've just completed a trial to do that. We took patients with lung lesions. They had a CAT scan. 5 minutes later, they had another CAT scan. And what we're doing now is we're analyzing that data. So hopefully we'll be able to get that out by the end of the year. I think what we're going to see is probably about roughly 10%. Anything above 10% is real. So if it shrinks by 10%, it's going to be a sign of shrinkage. If it grows by 10 or 11%, it's very likely to be growth. So having those numbers are very helpful because you're going to either have greater enthusiasm to continue a drug, or you're going to stop it a lot earlier. I think that's what we're going to do. The second thing we're doing as part of that is we're using volumetric measurements, which can be done from the same CT data that you get on a normal helical scan. It's just a different software. And what we've seen already is that there is a quicker and more substantial differentiation between growth and shrinkage based on volume. So it may very well be that volume is going to be better. And, you know, I think there's kind of uniform agreement that there's got to be a better way than the RECIST system to say whether or not cancer grows or shrinks. It's a very imprecise system and was created long before we had the CAT scanner.
What do you see as the future, if any, of induction systemic therapy? Or do you think there'll be trials comparing induction to post-op therapy? Or, you know, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think a lot depends on that current NATCH trial. There is a trial that I believe has concluded enrollment now in Spain where people were randomized to have immediate surgery, to have induction therapy followed by surgery, or to have surgery followed by adjuvant chemotherapy. And I think that will tell a lot. So to me, whether that trial may point us in one direction, it's probably more likely to show that multimodalities can be better than surgery alone. And whether it shows that they're comparable or one is better than the other, I would still, again, favor the induction for the reasons I said.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the newer research strategies and therapies that have come out, one being nab-paclitaxel, which you've done some work on. Where are we with that, and where do you think it's heading?
Well, there's been fairly extensive use of nab nanoparticle or albumin-bound paclitaxel is the generic name that our pharmacy has come up with in breast cancer, suggesting worse equivalents and probably better. It has one clear toxicity advantage, and that is the lack of hypersensitivity reactions. I find them very nasty, and I'm not the person living through them. They're very frightening to the patients and potentially deadly. though blessedly it's a very rare occurrence. The ones with docetaxel 2, they're not quite as dramatic. They're equally nasty. This kind of pain syndrome people seem to get with docetaxel, this back pain requiring narcotics is something you just don't want to subject a patient to. And you don't do that with nab-paclitaxel. So to me, with pretty good evidence of equivalence and this advantage in toxicity, it has an edge. Issues of reimbursement, though, have cropped up. And these things are going to have to be sorted out. But it seems to me that a drug that is equivalent, and I believe that's what the essence of the approvals were, that it was at least equivalent to paclitaxel. I think not having hypersensitivity reactions is a reason to switch. Other than that, the toxicities I find very comparable, alopecia, neutropenia, neurotoxicity, and it's the same sort of careful observation, dose attenuation, you know, observing your patient for those side effects, intervening when you have to. I find those things very comparable to Pacli or Dosi, but the hypersensitivity reaction is something that's clearly not comparable.
What about the neurotoxicity? Is that an issue in lung cancer?
It was the dose limiting. Well, we didn't do a phase one, we did a phase two trial, but clearly it was the toxicity that forced us to stop therapy in patients.
The last thing I want to ask you about is just an update on TKIs, erlotinib, gefitinib. What's come out over like maybe the last year or so in terms of EGFR mutations that you think are important for oncologists to know about in practice?
I think the realization that when you have a mutation, you can pretty much guarantee a response. The response rates in the four prospective trials that have been reported so far are really in excess of 75%. I think it's just amazing that for 10 to 20,000 people a year, we suddenly have a drug that works 7 or 8 out of 10 times. It's just amazing. I think that opens up possibilities for those individuals, no matter what stage they are. I think that's the most important piece of information that's come out in the last year or so. And we have a test that can do it. There's also been developments on mechanisms of resistance. There are many drugs coming up that seem, at least in the laboratory, to have the capability to kill cells that develop resistance, that develop secondary mutations. There's been the recent identification that the overexpression of another cancer proliferation and growth promoting pathway, the MET pathway, that too is overexpressed. That gene is amplified in patients that develop resistance, some with new mutations, some not. That's very encouraging because there are many drugs in clinical trial that target MET.
What exactly is happening there?
Well, unfortunately, the cancer cells are pretty damn smart. And while they are critically dependent on mutations, there are clearly parallel or redundant or bypass pathways for cell survival that they can activate through upregulation. And that appears to be what they're doing. So that understanding those pathways, you know, can give us another way to do that. And so it may be, though, that if you had an addicted cancer cell, that if you gave a MET inhibitor and an EGFR inhibitor, you could tremendously prolong the length of response or maybe even cure the patient because you're denying that cancer cell that pathway as a way to bypass the effect of EGFR.
Have clinical responses been seen with MET inhibitors in this situation?
I'm unaware that, well, in the clinical responses, I haven't seen any data that they've been tested yet. Most of the MET inhibitors are in phase one trial right now, and this MET story is only a few months old. Very quickly, though, it's going to happen that those MET inhibitors are going to be tested in that situation.
What are your thoughts about the combination of a TKI like erlotinib with bevacizumab?
I think there's a lot of empiric rationale to do that. I mean, it's two active drugs, totally different side effect profiles, totally different mechanisms of action. I mean, all the reasons we choose drugs to work, we choose to combine drugs empirically, we have here. But I'm unaware of any kind of scientific rationale beyond the empiric that putting these two together. I mean, clearly you can do it. Many of us do that routinely.
In what situations?
People use it in second-line therapy. This was much more common before Bev was more widely available, that you've had a patient who had progressed on standard therapy and you're giving a lot of second-line, people give a lot of bevacizumab. We also are using it in some patients up front that are candidates for both drugs. It makes sense, I think, to do that, particularly if you have somebody with a mutation or a clinical scenario that suggests a high likelihood of mutation. like a woman who's a never smoker, she has at least a 50-50 chance of having a mutation. It would make sense to give that person chemo plus bevacizumab. And the safety is pretty clear in the studies that were done.
What are your thoughts about ZD6474's Actemra, which, the way I understand it, is in some ways kind of a combination of a VEGF inhibitor and EGFR inhibitor?
Yeah. Well, there have been a lot of clinical trials. There is no definitive clinical trial that shows that it's an advantage over another targeted agent. And there still is no definitive trial saying combining it with chemo provides an advantage over chemo alone. I mean, these trials are in progress now. The data is equivocal at this point, and we'll just have to wait to see if it comes in, if something works out. You know, there's pros and cons for these multi-targeted agents. It's nice to go after different receptors, but unfortunately, the specificity and potency of an individual drug for different receptors, it's not the same. And the question is out there, could you do a better job by giving a very potent EGFR inhibitor and a very potent VEGF2 inhibitor than giving a combination drug that is less potent or less specific for those same two sites? And only time will tell if that's true.
How do you approach the decision of second-line therapy in a non-protocol setting?
I think it's based like any, well, I would urge that first line is where you make your best shot to personalize that therapy based on clinical characteristics, pathological characteristics, molecular characteristics, and also the side effect profile that's appropriate for that patient. If you've done that up front, you would again reapply it second line, but we don't have that as many kind of choices at that point. A lot of it depends on patient condition at the time, again, side effect profiles, but in general, you know, using drugs of a different class, non-overlapping side effects, that's how that choice gets made. I think you really can't pick one drug that's right for people. I mean, just to talk about pemetrexed, I think many people have turned to pemetrexed in that second-line setting. It's approved for that. Number one, that makes it easy. Chemo is the right choice for virtually every patient because most patients do not have these EGFR-addicted tumors. And I would hope that when you found such a patient, you would have already given them an EGFR inhibitor first-line anyway. And I think a lot of people turn to that because of non-overlapping toxicities. It doesn't have renal problems. It doesn't have neuropathy that people may have had from a prior taxane or a prior platinum agent. But that situation may be changing as well based on the recent data reported at the IASLC meeting, the Scagliotti trial, that compared pemetrexed and cisplatin to gemcitabine and cisplatin. That trial suggested that for patients with adenocarcinoma and large cell carcinoma, that there was a survival advantage. Well, it suggested there was a survival advantage and conclusively proved that they were equivalent. That, too, was a non-inferiority trial. It nailed that endpoint in spades.
With less toxicity.
Yeah, with less toxicity. Though that, I don't think, was a goal of the trial, but yes, it had less toxicity. Yeah. But I think anybody who's used GEM and PEM would know that the PEM is probably easier for most people. But there was that suggestion that it was a better drug. There was almost a two-month improvement in median survival in the adenos, an even greater one in large cell, favoring the PEM-CIS. Again, yes, it was a subgroup analysis, but it's a damn robust subgroup analysis. There was over 1,000 patients in that subgroup that suggested there's a two-month survival improvement. And again, that's what we do with effective new therapies. We see a two-month improvement. So it may be very possible to see how more and more people, because of toxicity and because of that data suggesting equivalence, if not improvement in survival, that for adeno and large cell patients, they're going to be giving pemetrexed up front. That will change the second line setting. There's also a lot of individual data about the safety of giving bevacizumab with pemetrexed in CIS. There's at least one small clinical trial from Dr. Patel from Northwestern suggesting that you can safely give bevacizumab with pemetrexed and carboplatin, that regimen is going to become used first line, and then different decisions will be made second line.
And do you see it heading into the adjuvant setting eventually?
It would make sense to do that. The only negative of that is the bigger problem in the adjuvant setting isn't the drug combined with cisplatin, it's cisplatin. Cisplatin, if you believe the ERCC1 data, it's inappropriate for 40% of the patients and from a outcome status, but it's also inappropriate for a huge proportion of patients because of its toxicities. So it's possible, but you know, to mount the kind of trial to say that that is better is going to be tough. I mean, really, you'd have to have a head-to-head trial, but it's probably not worth it.
You think a couple of years from now it's going to be carbo, pemetrexate, and bev as first-line therapy?
Unless another agent with a higher degree of benefit comes along, it makes a lot of sense that that would be. I mean, people are so comfortable with pemetrexate, and this data saying you absolutely don't harm anybody, and indeed there's a potential for benefit, why not?
Is it enough for you to do it now?
It is for me, sure.
Is that what you're doing?
Personally, I'm in a different kind of situation. I tend to have clinical trials,
sure,
by and large. And to be honest with you, I treat very few people up front, off study, with regimens. They almost all treat it on investigational agent, investigational protocol. But again, to me, all the facts say that it's reasonable. And again, you certainly don't harm people. And the suggestion is that it's better. And I think it makes some sense. Remember, our decision to use bevacizumab with a 2-month survival benefit is based on 600 patients. This is a decision based on over 1,000 patients to get that same 2-month improvement. And what you don't see there to get that 2 months is the added toxicity of the bevacizumab, those 12 extra people that died. That did not happen in this trial. Just one last point about other agents that may be appropriate, and that is the use of cetuximab. From the very beginnings of the concept of using anti-EGFR strategies in fighting cancer, lung cancer was chosen, and lung cancer was chosen because of the presence of EGFR in virtually every lung cancer. For various reasons, cetuximab, anti-EGFR therapy, monoclonal antibody, has not been used and not been extensively studied, frankly, in lung cancer. Only recently have there been large phase 3 trials where cetuximab was given with chemotherapy. There was a report by Tom Lynch combining cetuximab with carboplatin paclitaxel presented at the ISLC meeting in Seoul that did not suggest a benefit in progression-free survival, I believe. However, there was a trial just reported via press release, the so-called FLEX trial, where cetuximab was combined with vinorelbine cisplatin, and indeed they claimed to have met their primary endpoint, which was a survival endpoint. So this data has not been presented or extensively reviewed, but that would suggest a role for that. So that too may change the landscape in coming months. One thing about cetuximab as well is that I would postulate right now that that same story about RAS mutations defining a population likely to benefit would hold true, and that may very well be that we'll be able to use that as a way of selecting lung cancer patients for cetuximab use, just like we're going to be doing shortly in colorectal cancer. So that's another way to take this forward. And frankly, we need a treatment for people that can't receive bevacizumab. And squamous cell cancers, by their nature, do not have RAS mutations, so immediately they would be ones that would be a good target for this.
Do not have RAS mutations?
They do not have RAS mutations, yeah.
Strange.
So, yeah, I'm just learning about RAS mutations myself. We're just publishing a paper now. Actually, never smokers have them as well. That's another thing that I was shocked to discover.
Why?
Well, people have always associated with smoking.
Oh, that's interesting.
And we're in the process of, we reported at ASCO, and we have a manuscript out under review now to report that.
What fraction of non smokers have it?
It's about 15%, but that's not too far off from the, you know, 20 or so percent. They have a different RAS mutation, though. It's kind of interesting. They have the one that people with pancreas cancer would have. So it may impart some kind of different significance to those people. So it's, again, something we've just seen, and we'll see where that leads us. But just in closing, I think I'm encouraged by the number of compounds we have in the clinic and definitely coming down the clinical research track that hopefully will be able to improve outcomes, but also match therapies to patients, which I think is really, really important.